So no further announcements. I'm going to bring up our headliner right now, Herb Sutter.
Well, did you all enjoy Bjarne's keynote yesterday? Now, you already told John that, but I have a more specific question for you. In Bjarne's keynote, how many of you, just by show of hands, how many of you found at least one thing you want to go and try and apply back at work? Lots of hands. That's great, because these guidelines are meant to be used that Bjarne announced yesterday. And I know that you've been paying attention to it, because we noticed it. This is a snapshot as of around 6 o'clock this morning of the top repos trending worldwide over the past week, and this has only been available for a few days, over the past week, and you'll notice who's in number one spot. Now, we do have many hundreds of people in the room, in the high hundreds, so the better part of 1,000 people are here, but this is clearly more than just you. So those who are in the room, those who are watching this on demand afterwards, thank you very much for your support, because you make this possible. You guys, you rock. Thank you very much for this. Now, in case you're wondering what other repos are hot this week, you might have noticed if you tune into CNN and other news outlets that you see things like Xcode Ghost, the very first ever malware for iOS. There was also a new major new version of iOS released. The Xcode Ghost and iOS 9 sampler projects are trending this week as well. They're number 3 and number 4, and combined, they don't match your interest in C++ coding standards. Thank you for your interest. It's very exciting times. When we think about C++, as Bjarne said yesterday, we already have so much goodness. How many of you are regularly writing code more like the right-hand side in production today? That is great to see. The number of hands going up increases every year because, you know, you got to adopt tools, you got to have management buy-in to be able to use them. And yet the code on the left-hand side of the screen still works. It's a great compatibility story. This talk is very much part two of Bjarne Stroustrup's keynote yesterday. We're going to go into more detail on some specific things that he said. And for completeness, to make it a standalone talk, especially for those who are watching this on demand, may not have been here, or maybe watching these out of order, I'll mention a few highlights, but we'll go through the first few slides pretty quickly, because a lot of it is just sort of rounding out a little bit of what Bjarne said yesterday. And then we're going to take a deep dive onto a topic that you have already been asking about in the corridors that I've been hearing and the buzz overnight, and that we'll talk about today. So we have this, the old, new, delete, non-range 4 C++, and we have the new, better tools. Can we ever make those be the default? I mean, compatibility is great. We never want to just remove the old features, at least not for decades, because compatibility is really important. But can we get to a mode where we actually have the new stuff only on by default? And if you try to write the older code, you actually get a warning or an error, and you can still access the old code. Nobody's trying to take anything away from you. Nobody tries to take anything away successfully from C++ programmers, but you just open the hood, and then you can use them. It's like a drawer of knives, to use a popular expression. We want the knives. We are chefs. It's our business to use knives. But the knife drawer might not be one we want open by default. We want it to open it when we need it, but have the good and safe and simple parts be the ones that are on by default most of the time. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And first, to start with acknowledgments, as Bjarne announced, the C++ core guidelines are all about getting these good new parts by default, and we need your help with that. They're sort of in an 0.6 state right now, and that's the repo that we just talked about a minute ago. There's also an initial reference implementation of the guideline support library that works on various platforms and compilers, but we encourage you, contribute to it, send bug reports to it, but also make new ones. That shouldn't be the only one available in the world. And then checker tools, some of which we'll see this morning, the first one of those will also be available, and we're actually going to see it in action in a few minutes. The people on the bottom of the slide have contributed greatly already. The people on the bottom of the slide, if you're in the room or anybody who works directly with one of the people on the bottom of the slide, would you please stand up just for a moment? Please stand up if your name is on the bottom of the slide or you work directly with one of those people. Thank you for everything you've already done to get us to this point. This is the work of many people already, and we hope many, many more. So thank you very much. Bjarne talked about a superset and then a subset. The idea is that C++ is very good at supersetting. This is progress. We get new standard libraries, we get new features, but we still have some of the more dangerous or older features available. Great compatibility story. What we would like to do is, through core guidelines, extend that to have safe replacements for all the unsafe parts. Once you have the safe replacements, you have a complete system again, complete toolbox, replacements for all the unsafe parts, then you can turn those unsafe parts off by default. They're still there, nobody's taking them away, but you actively open the box when you want to make use of them. This helps us to have the goodness of compatibility, but also start to evolve the language more than just by adding things. I'm going to talk specifically about type and memory safety. A lot of people think that C++ and type and memory safety shouldn't be in the same talk. This talk is about nothing but that. The traditional definition of type and memory safety is really, if you boil it down, there's three parts that go together. One is type safety, so I'm not going to pun a type and use a T as a U when they're unrelated. Then memory safety has two components: bound safety, I'm not going to go outside the bounds of an allocation, and lifetime safety, I'm not going to access an invalid allocation. Put those three things together, and then you have what we commonly refer to in the industry as type and memory safety. There's a few variations in the definitions, but that's the crux of it. Now, those are the things we're going to focus on initially that I'm going to talk about today. We are also interested in concurrency safety, but that's not part of the initial target. We absolutely do want to get there too, and security and other kinds of profiles. But here's the guarantee, just to be very clear about what we are and we are not aiming to do. C++ code compiled in the safe subset, so with these particular parts of guidelines turned on, is never the root cause of type or memory safety errors, unless you opened the hood and explicitly said, unsafe me. Go and let me do something that I know is wrong, in which case you've documented the point you need to audit in your code. So these three parts, it applies to code you recompile. It does not apply to a third-party library you don't recompile. We assume you trust your libraries. If they have type unsafe or memory unsafe problems, you know where to look. But in the code that you control, you know you won't have root causes in the code that you recompile. You never need to audit that code for safety that compiles cleanly with these rules unless you opted out. And then you know, have it documented in source exactly the places where you said, trust me, that you need to go back and check if something does happen. Now, this means we are not aiming to provide a guarantee of verifiable whole program guarantee. It is a whole program guarantee, but this idea of verifiable code that you see that some languages talk about as their aim, none of the safe languages actually achieve that. Everybody, every program in any language eventually calls unsafe code. When you call unsafe code, an error in that unsafe code can cause an error anywhere in the code, including you can fall over in your safe code. But the root cause isn't there. The root cause is in the unsafe part. So really, this guarantee is very much like what any safe language guarantees, but we're being very explicit about it and candid about it. If you don't recompile your library, you say, yeah, you trust it. We're not going to check it for you. You need to independently use other tools to verify that it's correct. But hey, you have its source code? Compile it and we'll help you. So I talked about profiles, and we'll talk about three specific ones. I use the term profile just to talk about a group of rules that hang together and achieve a specific guarantee. So we're going to talk about bound safety, lifetime safety, and type safety. And I'm going to go through a couple of them fairly quickly because we're probably familiar with most of what's in them. But we do want to extend in the future, like I said, to additional forms of safety. Safe arithmetic, concurrency, possibly no accept or no alloc profiles, which are of interest to some people, but those are not ones that we've worked on so far. Let's talk about type safety. I'm only going to show you one slide about it, and this is sort of the summary slide we'll come back to and fill in. It's not complete, but it's to give us a roadmap and remember what we've talked about. So don't use a location as a T if that memory location actually contains an object of an unrelated type U. Now remember what we're doing. We're supersetting, then subsetting. The superset isn't just for fun. It's specifically to say, what are the unsafe parts that we want to ban that do not yet have standard safe replacements? Now, C++ 11 got us most of the way. I'd say it's roughly 60, 70% of the way to type of memory safety compared to C++ 98. But it wasn't a coordinated effort to drive out and provide alternatives for every source of undefined behavior and unsafety to give a safe alternative to it. That's what we're attempting to do. So what do we need to add? Well, we already have much type safety. Most of C++ is already type safe. But it's useful to talk about a separate byte type, because a raw byte, raw memory, is not a character. I know it's the same size and layout. I know it's the same bits. But in the type system, a character is not the same as a byte. And it's useful to distinguish those two things. And a variant, which is undergoing standardization right now. And once you say that, you can do things like say, don't use unions. So here is type safety in the single slide I'll talk about, because most of you are familiar with it. The rules, the first column, are all about don't do bad casting, including static down casting that are unchecked, reinterpret casting, const casting away const. Just don't do that, unless you really need to call a const on safe libraries, but like wrap them and do the cast in one place then. And number four, by the way, don't do C-style casts that would do one of those. Because remember, C-style casts can do any of those. They're specified as try this cast. And if that doesn't work, try this cast. And then if that doesn't work, there's a cascade of four alternatives. Those same ones need to be turned off for C-style casts. So we still allow C-style casts syntactically. But the ones that would invoke those unsafe casts would become errors or warnings. The right-hand side, don't use a variable before it's been initialized, whether it's a member or a local, and don't use unions. Don't use var args. Those are candidates for type punning. Now, we were divided on whether to put safe math into this profile, because it is, you could view it as a form of type safety, but as I mentioned before, it really fits to be its own profile, in particular because it has its own overheads, which type safety does not, but that one may, because of the checking and narrowing. So we'll also be interested in safe math, but that's not included in this particular profile. The summary is what's shown here. And there are still things we're working on for this particular profile. One of the things you will not see in the guideline support library that Bjarne talked about in the coding guidelines, the core guidelines, and you won't see in the GSL implementation, that first reference implementation, you won't see variant. And that is because the committee is very close to agreeing, we hope, possibly as soon as next month in Kona, on what variant should be. So since they're so close, let that continue. Why invent another one? On the other hand, you'll see with bounds, with array view and string view, we have taken the opportunity to take something that's undergoing standardization and say, with minor tweaks, it could help us achieve this as well, which we can feedback as contributions for the standards committee to consider. So speaking of that, let's talk about bound safety. I've got an allocation, but I want to make sure that I don't access memory out of bounds. Here, the replacement types are array view and string view, which are, I said, are already in a TS form. In this model, there are two main differences to the TS versions, if you're familiar with those. The first is string view isn't read-only. You can have a read-only one, but it's also read-write, because sometimes you want that. Furthermore, array view and string view are not two different types. Array view is the only type. String view is just a templated alias to an array view, which changes a couple of defaults. It says, by the way, you really only want one dimension. We could not think of a reason to have multidimensional strings. If you think of one, let us know. Our imaginations were hampered there. And I want to point out that in the entire guideline support library, array view is the primary type. The only other one is not null that incur any runtime overhead. Everything else is done statically at compile time. But we do want full disclosure. Array view and then not null do incur some runtime overhead. And so we're working to make sure that we drive those down so that that's not a reason not to adopt these safe replacements. Once you have that, you say, don't use pointer arithmetic. If you look at rule number one, what's that really saying? Another way of stating rule one is a pointer only points to one object. That's what pointers should do. That's what the vast majority of actual pointers in our code do, is refer to a single object. Don't use array to pointer decay. Don't use the unsafe functions. So how do we use ArrayView instead? Well, let's talk about that. Here's an example that's adapted from actual code. The guideline support library was iterated on and derived from actual code examples. So we would take code from network protocol handlers, from low-level OS kernel routines, for string manipulation, network transport, all sorts of different places, and actually work on the code examples and say, how should these look with ArrayView, with not null, that kind of thing. And we went down many false paths. That's part of exploring a design space, and backed up and came up with just a few types that hang together well. One of these examples and one of these types is what you see here. On the left-hand side, you'll see code, which, if you're familiar with Microsoft SAL, the static annotation language, which are extensions primarily for C, in this case, as far as they go for bounds safety. It says, hey, look, that pointer you've got there, things, and that unsigned count, oh, by the way, those go together. Oh, okay. Static analyzer uses that information, and the static analyzer can catch some error, such as, did you notice that you said not less than or equal to instead of less than there? Don't want to do that. Now, a traditional compiler will compile that just fine, but many static analysis tools already will catch that error on the left-hand side. And things like passing the wrong size to memcopy because we passed a count of things, not a count of bytes. Did you catch that? Or at the end, passing the wrong size. We say, here are 30 things, but really there's only 10. On the other side of the screen, you see we use an array view. The ArrayView simply is a replacement for pointer comma length. ArrayView of t lets you say const t. If it's an ArrayView of const t, that means you can read them all day long, you just can't write to the t's. So there's a distinction, just like with pointers, of the ArrayView itself being const, which means you can't point it to something else, and the things it points to being const, meaning you can't write through the ArrayView. And of course, you can have both as well. You can have a const array view of const t, if that makes sense, just like pointers. It turns out that in many cases now, this makes our code simpler. You can use range 4 directly with this instead of iterating through the loop. You can call std copy, and here I'm taking the liberty of stealing ideas from and anticipating Eric's ranges talk on Friday, because that is a rangeified version, conceptually, of std copy, which will do the right thing, even if thing is not a pod. And then down at the bottom, notice that we can often deduce the sizes of things. We know the sizes of arrays and std arrays. We can deduce those for you and create array views directly from that. That's implicit. It requires no extra code. But if you want to call the API explicitly the way you used to, like for instance, the old API you might have called with pointer comma length, let's say all your call sites had that. Well, notice the second call at the bottom. Generally, most of the time, especially if they were in that order, pointer comma length, just put braces around them. We have the nice uniform initialization rules in C++11 that just says, oh, by the way, I know you're trying to use an array view. Here, let me make one for you without repeating the type. So that's very convenient for compatibility. And of course, if you lie and say the wrong number, now we can enforce it because we know that what you said isn't true. And we can check that as a combination of statically and dynamically. Now, in all of this, a key goal was not to have any serious regressions from what static analysis could already do. If the after lost valuable information that you had with SAL annotations, for example, or the similar annotations you have on other platforms with other compilers, then we've lost something serious. That rarely happens. We preserve nearly all the static analysis information because the static analyzer, the compiler, knows ArrayView. This is a popular type, a vocabulary type that not only all programmers can agree on, but that the compiler, the tools can know about and know the semantics of, like any standard or hopefully standard type. And so it gets all the same information out of that it got out of the SAL you see, plus many of the checks are now done at compile time using the type system. There's also a fixed length array, ArrayView, where you can just do the computation at compile time in code, no analysis required. So we have no regressions from the analysis, and the analyzer has less work to do because we're using the type system. And the target is zero call overhead. So as you do the actual use of the ArrayView to index, you may get bounds checks there. We want to hoist those. But just saying that an ArrayView is the type of your parameter should not cause overhead in calling the function compared to just raw pointer and length. And so we're working very hard to make that be true. Now, what if you really did want to use something unsafe? Well, here's an example of how you might opt out of bound safety. Most of the time, I don't want you to do that, so this is the only slide I'm going to show the syntax. But you might have noticed in other languages, often you see the keyword unsafe on a block, which basically says, okay, now you can do unsafe stuff. And that's where I started with the design as I was working on this, and several people gave me very good feedback that, you know, that's not very satisfying. And the reason is because it lets you do too much. It's a bit. It's like, oh, there's something unsafe in here. Maybe all you meant to do is a bounds unsafe operation that couldn't be verified at compile time by the tool, but that you knew was safe. But because you said unsafe with no ability to distinguish what was unsafe, you might do that and an accidental union use or type punning or something else. Instead, we want you to be able to suppress specific core guidelines rules, including profile rules, and say exactly what it is you're saying trust me on in this line of code. Suppress type.cast, suppress bounds if you want to just escape the bounds profile. And you can suppress a specific guideline rule number in the guidelines that we're publishing. This is the model that we're following, so you can be very crisp and self-documenting. And that way, if you suppress one thing, you don't accidentally suppress warnings on other errors you might make. You still catch those. And here's an example. If you do want to use it here, you can say suppress bounds. Darn it, I do want to call memcopy. Just trust me. And even there, you're still getting some other benefit because by using an ArrayView, you can say, hey, give me the number of bytes, the number of things, instead of the number of things, and it solves other kinds of errors even when you do use the unsafe APIs. Another benefit of these, which isn't related to safety, but it's a convenience thing, is let's say that you wanted to write a piece of code that could take the storage that's contiguous that might be stored in a vector or an array or a pointer length, and you wanted to write a single function that could accept any of those. Well, one option is to write a template that just gets stamped out for every contiguous container type that it might be passed. Better, just say, I want an array view of ints. And then you can call that with whether the storage is owned by a std vector, pointer length, an array, or your own container. This is even more compelling for strings. How many of you have your own homegrown string type at your companies? Don't lie. Right. And those of you who didn't put up your hands and are just bashful, we know we have them. A bunch of these are Microsoft ones. There's Qt ones up there, ICE ones up there. And this is certainly not a complete list because we just don't have enough slide space in the world to show them all. But if you write just the function takes a string view or a wstring view, you can call it with all of these. Now, the nice thing is, because string view is a well-known type, and there's, you get the wide character alias one as well with a w and the narrow character one, that means if you have your custom string type, all you need to do is write a conversion operator from your custom string type to string view. And now you can just pass it to everything that takes a string view, which is we hope is going to be much more and more code, because that's the way to specify, I want to see string data. So that's the bound safety profile. It's about not going beyond the bounds of an allocation. The main replacement tool is ArrayView and StringView, which is an alias for ArrayView. We ban pointer arithmetic. We ban out-of-bounds array accesses. And what we're working on now is to make sure those things are as cheap to pass as parameters as a naked pointer length. So that affects calling convention and ABI. So that's one thing that we're investigating. We believe we can do, but I'm documenting where we are and what the next pieces are. And we want to make sure that we eliminate redundant checks so that the checking overhead for doing the bounds checking is easily adoptable. It's not a barrier to adopting this, that you don't want to turn it off in safe code. And that brings us finally to the lifetime profile. And this one's easy. We can talk about this in a slide, because really only you need to do three things. Delete every heap object once. That way you don't have any leaks. Delete it only once. That means you have no corruption. And never deref a pointer to a deleted object, and then you have no dangling. So how many of you knew that already? Good, okay. So that's safety in C++. Okay, you're not really going to let me get away with that.
No.
It's really easy to say what the requirements are. It's way harder to do it. A lot of people have spent large fractions of their careers on this problem. And I'm very grateful, especially to Bjarne Strustrup and also to Neil McIntosh and others who are in this room. For a few years, I've been talking about taking a run at this, and just over the past year have taken a serious run at this. It's a lot of work. We believe it works, but we are also going to give you a snapshot of where we are with the design. There's a paper that's now published on the CPP coding core guidelines repo that talks in more detail about what I'm going to show you. So I refer you to that paper for details. But this is a hard, hard problem that people have tried to solve for native languages for 40 years. There are many attempts that either failed or blossomed but took us in other directions. For example, many attempts like Cyclone, C-Cured, focused on safety, memory safety for C, eliminating dangling and leaks for C on the grounds that C is a simpler language. That's only half true. C is a simpler language. C++ code is simpler than C code because it contains more information. It is simpler to deal with C++. That's one observation. The second is they may incur runtime overheads, such as default on or expectation of garbage collection. And many languages have gone down that road. But that doesn't meet our requirements because we want zero overhead. This is C++. Others rely on whole program analysis. I mean, even at Microsoft, there are two tools that you might have heard of, Prefix and Prefast. Prefix is a wonderful static analysis tool that works on a whole program basis and catches lots of good stuff and errors deterministically. And Prefast is the one that's actually run, because this one can't scale to large programs and can't run until you get to universe heat death kind of time frames. You need Prefast, which is mostly right and makes some guesses and has more false positives. Whole program analysis doesn't get us there, doesn't scale. Extensive annotation. Many languages have gone down this route. Rust, very recently, and also Cyclone and others rely on extensive annotation, which are difficult for the programmer to understand, and show that there's really something missing in the source code. The less we have to annotate, the more we realize the information is already there in the source code. Or they invent a new language, or one or more of the above. So we believe we have something conceptually simple. I'm going to walk you through it, and it's going to rely on the fact that C++ contains really useful information. It has a very strong notion of scope. It has a very strong notion of lifetime. It has a very strong notion of bounds. And when you put those together and look at the ownership information already in the code, it turns out that you can do a really good job with what you find already there. So thank you again to Bjarne and Neil in particular. But now let's dive in. We're going to say we don't want any invalid or deallocated allocations. No using dangling pointers, no leaking memory. I added the slide last night because on the Reddit thread on Bjarne's talk, somebody said something along the lines of, yeah, because pointers are evil, and no, they're not. Of course you want indirection. Smart pointers are good, they encapsulate ownership. Of course, don't use them everywhere. Use them where they encapsulate ownership. Raw pointers and references are just fine, and you really want to use them on the stack, especially as locals and especially as parameters for parameter passing by reference, by pointer, because you want the speed and the leanness of just an address. Now, having said that, you want that without dangling. Let's talk. Here is the overview of the lifetime safety profile. The main concepts, notice these aren't types, they're concepts, an indirection, something that points to something else. And there's really two kinds. You either own the thing you point to or you don't. You're observing it. If you own it, like a unique putter, you can't dangle. If you're just observing to it, we'll call that a capital P pointer because it could be anything. It could be an iterator. It could be a raw pointer. It could be a range in the new ranges proposal, pair of iterators. Anything like that could be an array view, could dangle. We want to make sure that you don't use that reference to something it doesn't own longer than it's good for. So for the owners, we'll make sure you delete everything exactly once, proper cleanup. For the pointers, we'll make sure you don't dangle. This is the goal. Because right now, T-star is ambiguous as to whether it owns what it points to or not, as Bjarne pointed out yesterday, there's an owner of T-star wrapper that you usually use. If you must use a T-star and you can't use a unique putter or something better, that's fine, but put owner around it. It's just a type def, it's just an alias, but it's known to the tools and to the rules, so we can enforce that you do delete it properly. So now, let's dive in. The approach is that we have local rules, so we do not want to rely on whole program analysis which doesn't scale. A compiler just compiles a function at a time. That's the model we want, and we want to enforce it statically at compile time. That way you have zero runtime overhead. So for, I said array view for bound safety has some runtime overhead. Apart from the not null wrapper, which fits into here, nothing that I'm going to show you has any runtime overhead. There is exactly zero instrumentation. There is zero analysis or bookkeeping. These are all static rules run at compile time. Could be in the compiler, could be in another tool, in the build step, a static analyzer. Either could implement these things. You get whole program guarantees by compiling the whole program, a function at a time. We're going to identify who are the owners, so every object better have an owner, and we're going to track the pointers. If you're a pointer, we're going to track statically what do you point to. The goal is leak freedom for the owners and tracking points to avoid dangling for pointers. And we don't want you to have to go annotate heavily throughout your code, because that's a lot of work. Most of the time, the information's already there, and we can select defaults that are correct and are what you would have expected. You'll see them in a moment. The principles. A pointer tracks its pointees. We track the outermost object. If you've got an int that's a member of a class, and you've got a pointer to that int, I'm not gonna worry that it's a member, I'm just gonna track the enclosing object, because I know the lifetime of that int is the same as the lifetime of the enclosing object. That's just simpler. Same for array elements and the array. For a heap object, I'm gonna track the owner of the thing I point to. When I call functions, I'm going to assume that any pointers I pass in are independent by default and are going to be valid for the lifetime of the function. And if I return a pointer back out, I'm going to assume by default that you got it from the inputs, which is 99.99% of the time what happens. That's pretty much it. Those principles are pretty much the static analysis rules. However, we need the next level of detail, so let's start digging into that. First, I'll talk about local analysis. We'll look at the rules, warm up a little bit just inside a function body. Then in Acts 2 and 3, we'll talk about calling other functions. And I'll show a few function calls in Act 1 just as an aside, but we'll really dig into the function calls in Acts 2 and 3. So here's a warm up. Let's say I have three pointers which are outside of scope, so I can make them outlive something, right? This is the kind of error I'm trying to construct. Initially, they point to null. Then I go into a scope. I create a standalone int. I create another int that's a member of a structure. And just because I can, I make a std array of integers. And I'm going to point at the stack int, at the int member, and into the array of int, at one of the ints. Before I leave the scope, all those pointers are good, right? Why are they good? Yeah, they're stack variables, and you haven't left their scope yet. They're not destroyed yet. As soon as you pass line A, what happens? Yes. That's where we destroy A, S, and I. We invalidate P3, P2, P1. If I try to use P1, I should get an error. P was invalidated when I went out of scope at line A. Just curious. I know some tools already give you this error. How many of you are using tools today that give you errors that are roughly as readable for that second last line as P was invalidated when I went out of scope at line A? How many of you use such tools? I see about four hands. Got about over 700 people here, so about five or six hands, maybe 1%. And then the second line, the line at the bottom, of course we're trying to use two that have been invalidated, those are dangling pointers as well. And we would like similarly good error messages for those. I was thinking of calling Neil up to demo those errors, but you know, some tools do those today. These are pretty easy. A human could do it. Let's move on. But those are the errors we want diagnosed with that clarity of error message. Now let's see how taking an address works. I have an int, and I take a reference to it and a pointer to it. Remember, a reference is basically a pointer with different semantics. Sometimes in the language, it's interpreted as an alias instead of an indirection, so it's got this dual nature in language semantic terms. But for our purposes here, each is an indirection, each is a pointer, capital P. Ri points to I, Pi points to I. If I then take int star star PPI equals address of Pi, we don't need any special kind of information here. For the first couple, we said Ri points to I. We just track for Ri, what does it point to? Remember, we track this statically. We say Pi points to I. Well, what does PPI point to? It points to Pi. And what does Pi point to? Well, you can look that up separately, but we only need to remember one level. So what do I directly point to? But then you can follow pointer to pointer to chains once you've got that information. If I've got a shared putter, for example, at the bottom I've got a shared putter S which owns, that's why I'm using the darker color for an owner and an owning pointer. There's an owning indirection. It owns that int of with the value 2 that's on the heap. And in the final line, I take the address of the shared putter. He's an owner, but that's okay. So just PS points to S. It just happens to be that S is an owner, but that doesn't matter. It's PS points to S and is valid for as long as S exists. Make sense so far? These are baby steps, because then we're going to start running. One last warm-up, dereferencing. So let's go back to a condensed version of the previous example where we have PPI points to PI points to I. Okay? Now I create a new pointer, PI2 equals star PPI. How do I know what that is, and how do I get the right lifetime for PI2? Well, that's easy, because before that I do that, PPI points to PI, PI points to I. So when I say that expression, star PPI, I dereference PPI. Well, I know PPI points to PI, therefore star PPI is another name for PI. So really that line is the same as int star PI2 equals PI. I know this statically, clearly, which means not only do I take his value, the address stored in him, but I copy his points to list because I'm going to point to the same thing he points to. I go through star PPI, PPI points to PI, so star PPI is the same as PI. When I copy that pointer, I copy not just its contents, but also its points to list. And so PI2 points to I. But these seem like very simple rules, but we have to talk to a computer, because it only understands little simple rules one at a time. But on this, we can build a lot. Now, if I have another variable, J, and I change that middle pointer, that first pointer, PI, to swing him to point to J, this is kind of cool, because now if I dereference PPI twice, I now point to something else. But I didn't have to modify PPI's points to list. I just know that PPI points to PI. That's all I need to know is one hop. And then if I now reset PI2, I have that same line of code I had in the middle of the screen and I do it again. This time PI2 correctly points to J and I copy the points to list that says I'm pointing to J. Enough warm-ups? We are at EOW. And BOF. That was the easy stuff. I showed you taking a pointer to a shared pointer. Now let's talk about taking a pointer to the thing owned by a shared pointer. Now the thing about this is, yeah, the shared pointer's got a name here, it's S, right? What's the name of that int on the heap that the shared pointer owns? Ain't got one statically, right? It's okay, we'll invent one. His name is S prime. That's shorthand notation for what is owned by shared pointer S. So then when I say int star p equals s dot get, we'll get to function calls in a moment, that gives you a pointer that points to S prime. Now the rules are for that is that pointer is valid. How long should it be valid? Anyone want to take a guess? Until when? Until S is destroyed or modified. How do I know if something's modified? Oh, Bjarne invented this wonderful thing called const that C took as well. We already have that information. I know exactly the set of functions on SharedPutter that destroy it and modify it. Until one of those is called, P is just fine and dandy. But as soon as you call one of those, like call, reset it or swing it to something else, I know P has been reset. Again, how do I know? Because P points to something owned by S, and that means that for S prime, we say P is valid until S is destroyed or modified with a non-const use. Because that could point it to something else. Now, it's true, there could be false positives here. If you write S equals S, okay, it wouldn't actually move it, and we would still make that line, call that line an error, star P equals 43. Now, you could know, yeah, but I didn't actually swing it. That's okay. I'm willing to take some false positives. We're going to work to drive those down, but I want soundness. And I know that if you modify that shared putter, I can no longer trust that pointer. That depends on, that's a way to think about it, that depends on the current value of that owner, that shared putter. Make sense? How many of you believe right now, after seeing one slide in your heart of hearts, yes, I believe a tool could easily detect that? The rules I just said I want to emphasize are not specific to standard smart pointers. There is nothing hard-coded in these rules I just described that say, do this for shared putter. It's just, look, there's an owner. It happens to be shared putter. If you modify it, you invalidate the pointers you got from it that point to things it owns. It is not specific to that smart pointer. It will work for your smart pointers if you identify them as owners. And it's not specific to smart pointers. It works just fine for containers. But let's see, could a compiler really do this? Neil, where are you? Could you come up, please? Neil has been busily, in his team, busily writing a prototype to actually make sure that these rules will actually work. Based on the static analysis framework that Microsoft was already using, that works with, the, we talked about with prefast and prefix, but that also works with SAL annotations. Well, we want to use array views instead. We want to use these lifetime rules instead. So can you show us this example and what it looks like?
Sure.
Is your mic on?
I think so. Is it on? Yes. Right. I am on. Okay. So I think this, at a much larger font size, is approximately equivalent to what you just had on screen, correct? Right. So we have a shared pointer. We get a pointer from it. We dereference it. This program looks correct, if essentially useless.
I don't see any errors.
There are no errors.
Okay.
The error list is empty. Let's see what happens if we repoint it. I think you used 2, correct?
Sure. Any value. 42 okay. Is pretty good.
Nice. So then what we can do is we can take this pre-production version of Visual C. And we can run code analysis on that example. And we can see there's a little icon that says it's working. And oh, now we have an error. Let's see what it says. It's pink, because pink's pretty. And it says, don't dereference the invalid pointer that we just created, because at line 8, we reassigned S. And in fact, it tells us here, at line 8, we used operator equals to break that pointer.
Thank you very much. Now, don't go too far, because we'll want you back in just a moment.
Sure. Would you like your slides?
Thank you, Neil.
Pleasure.
So that's one example. But again, you didn't hard code anything specific to shared putter in the tool.
Nothing at all.
It's you modified an owner. We know the pointer points to the thing owned by S. You modified it. You invalidate the pointer. Next example. Here is an actual bug from Stack Overflow a few months ago. When I was writing up this part of my paper, I was looking for an example, and in my morning mail, before I could think of an example an hour before, this one came across the transom, and I thought, oh, I'll just cut and paste that. The exact quote was, this code compiles, but RA contains garbage. Can someone explain me why this code is invalid? So what's he doing? He's got myFun, which returns a unique putter by value. That's okay, it moves it out. Then he's calling it, and he's taking a reference to the returned A that's owned by the unique putter. And so what's wrong with that? Yes, it returns by value, which is fine because it moves. Yes, it's an R value. It's a temporary, which is then destroyed just as you're storing the reference to that destroyed object. Well, that's not good. So if we call that returned object temp up, what's really happening is that we're making a reference. Think of it as a temporary reference. We dereference the result of my fun call. That gives you a reference which conceptually points to something owned by temp up, which is that temporary that came back. As soon as, then you store it, but then as soon as you destroy temp up, you invalidate, just as if you'd modified it, you invalidate that reference. And so we say, hey, look, in fact, I would give an error right on making the reference because it can never be useful. If you initialize a reference as invalid, that's just useless. And if you try to use the reference, you'll get the error saying, in both cases, RA is invalid. It was initialized as invalid on line A. Now, the user said, can someone explain to me why this code is valid? And some good Samaritan did. Several did. Wouldn't it be nice if our compiler just told us that and we could save ink on Stack Overflow? That would be so much better. And this is not the first time somebody has asked this question. Could a compiler really do this, Neil?
Well, I hope so, otherwise we're going to feel very silly.
Let's see. But by the way, you'll have noticed that Neil is wearing the local colors. Turn around, Neil.
Go Hawks.
This is a noun, not a verb. You wear this to the design meetings this time of year quite a lot,
yes.
And I thought, hey, it would be great if you wore this on stage because it shows that we're loyal and we're optimists. And those are two good things when you're dealing with C++ and pointer lifetimes. Go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, that's right. Just here so I don't get fined. So, should we start with the error-based example this time? Okay, so let's see what happens if we run analysis on example 2. Goes away, it has a little bit of a think, oh, there's an error. Turns out we're dereferencing an invalid pointer again. And this time, it's trying to tell us what Herb went through on the slide, which is that RA was invalidated, if you can read the text in the message, at line 14, the light pink line. It was invalidated by a destructor of unique pointer being called. And why would that be being called, Herb?
Because you returned a temporary.
Right. So, now, how would we fix this?
Well, there's a couple of ways to fix it. One way would be just to store the unique pointer. In fact, that's what the Stack Overflow answerer said.
Okay, so we should probably change what we're putting it into, correct?
Well, what you can do is have a just auto p equals my fun.
Okay, let's leave that there then.
Mm-hmm.
Is that capital A? Yes. So you mean auto P? Oh, somebody changed my
Dvorak keyboard.
Yes. Auto P was my fun. How about that?
And then that one can just deref P. That should be safe, right? Because now we're actually keeping the unique pointer, which is helpful.
Okay. Should we try?
The worst that can happen is we find a bug in the prototype.
True. Or our brains. It's thinking, oh, no errors. Looks like we fixed the bug.
Okay, so that's one way to do it.
Nice.
Now, that's what you normally tell people. That's what we were told on Stack Overflow. If you just control Z back to the original.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of you might have noticed, if you do not need to know the following. I'm going to stick with simple examples because they're plenty enough. But many of you know that there's advanced parts of C++. You notice there's a const reference local variable. Why did that not do lifetime extension for the temporary? Because it was two different type. It was a reference to A, not a reference to the unique putter. Now, if you don't know about lifetime extension for const reference locals, good. You shouldn't need to. The only reason I mention it here is because we're going to stick with simple examples. But if you do and know and want to use the advanced stuff, it works too. And I'll just use this as a case in point and then not mention the advanced stuff as much. But in this case, the simplest thing you could do to change this is to change A to auto. And then you don't need to deref. You can move the deref down to the use line. And this should do the temporary lifetime extension. If you don't know what that is, don't worry. Just ignore this part. But this ought to work because now the temporary lifetime ought to be extended. And so if we rebuild this.
Really? Pushing our limits here, let's see. Thinking, no errors. We succeeded.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Oh, we're going to need Neil in a minute here. This one's hard. Let's go a little bit more exotic. Let's say you have a shared pointer to a vector of ints, and I'm trying to help with diagrams off to the side, and we take pointers to every single level. So I have a shared pointer to vector, that's SV down at the bottom, and it points to a vector which has no name, it's just the vector owned by the shared pointer, and it owns a buffer of ints. And I'm going to have SV2 be a pointer, a raw pointer to SV, which is an owner. I'm going to have vec be a raw pointer to the vector, which is an owner, and I'm going to have putter be a raw pointer to the integer that's owned by the vector that's owned by the shared putter. Clear as mud? This is what we ask compilers to do all the time. We're so mean. Now, if I use that putter right now, it's fine because it's pointing to a valid integer and I got it through a valid path. Now, what could I do to disturb this world and upset this apple cart? Oh, there's lots of places to kick. Let's kick at vec. So the first thing we'll try is we'll say vec pushback 1. Now, this might not actually move memory. So the pointer might still be valid-ish, but according to the standard, it's invalidated. Now, the standard says that in English text. We'd like to say it with a deterministic rule that a compiler and a tool can enforce. So we say vec pushback 1 invalidates putter. Now, why? Now, here's where I'm going to show there's a second level of prime. Now, there's only two. If you say SV prime, 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 we're only going to track two levels. So we're going to give you a few false positives, but it turns out that covers many of the interesting cases. So here, what we're saying is that SV2 points to SV, vec points to SV prime, I'm reading that blue bar on the in, and putter points to SV prime prime, that is something owned by SV. When I say vec arrow, that's the same as dereferencing it. That's the same as star vec. So, well, what does vec point to? Vec points to, star vec, is SV prime. So vec arrow, think that means SV prime. That is an expression which is the name of that unnamed vector. I then call pushback. That is a non-const operation. Therefore, it invalidates anything with another prime on that, anything that prime, which means it invalidates SV prime prime, which if you look at the three inputs, it invalidates only the pointer. Because it depends on something that depends on the shared putter. So we can say error, PTR was invalidated by the pushback on line A. I have been dying to get that kind of error message for many, many years. But now let's go back and do something else. So we'll reset to the original state, so same as before. But let's instead kick at another place. We'll kick at the shared putter. And let's just reset it. So that's going to blow away the vector. It's going to blow away the memory owned by the vector. But when I say star sv2.reset, what does sv2 point to? Well, if you read the table, it says sv2 points to sv. So star sv2 is another name for sv. I'm going to do a non-const operation on sv. That means I invalidate sv prime. Well, vec points to sv prime, so he's invalidated. And putter points to sv prime prime. Well, sv prime is part of that, so he gets invalidated also. So I invalidate both of those pointers. And if I try to use them, vec or putter, I say error, they were invalidated by the reset on line B. My one question is, could a compiler really do this?
What is there to lose? It's just public humiliation, right? Let's try it.
We're so used to that.
I think we're up to example 3. We are. So this one's going to take a little longer because a lot of stars, a lot of ampersands and brackets, and they all cost more. Let's see.
But initially that should be fine.
Let's just
make sure the baseline works. Because right now I set up the pointers and all I do is use them. I use the pointer to the vector and the pointer to the int. Does it agree?
It agrees.
All succeeded. Okay. So the first thing we wanted to do was modify the vector.
Okay. So
and there was a more complex expression. In fact, I can't remember what the
called.
Is it called
vec pushback? Is that what you did?
Yeah, that's probably it.
Vec pushback. You like
42. Oh, thank you.
So let's
Douglas Adams will be proud.
See what the tool thinks now.
And so now we've modified the vector, which could move its memory, so we should invalidate only the pointer. What does it say?
Oh, it's got an error. Let's see what it says.
So the error is on line?
it says the error starts at line 12 where you called standard vector pushback. Yep.
And the actual dereference, the problem is?
Line 14, where we're dereffing an invalid pointer called PTR.
Okay, so now let's go back and undo that and instead just modify SV2, reset SV2. That's the other thing we tried to do.
Okay.
So just SV2 error reset, I think, is what we did.
Like so.
So now the shared pointer to the vector, we're resetting it. So the vector and the storage it contains should go away, which means the pointer to the vector is also invalidated as well as the pointer to the integer inside it.
Ooh, now we have two warnings. What's happening here? Okay, vec is still being invalidated. It's being invalidated by the call to reset.
And vec was not invalidated before.
No, sorry, it was pointer. And there's pointer being invalidated as well. So we've caught both invalidations.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Pleasure.
We'll give you a pause. By the way, if you were looking closely at this, this might seem somewhat magical because I'm using unrelated aliases unrelated to the path I got the pointer from. If you notice where I got at the top of the screen, where I got the pointer from, so I got the pointer from SV through the path of SV, right? But look where SV2 is. It's off to the side. It's just a pointer to SV. It's unrelated to anything else. I never used SV2 for anything before that last line in the function. So that's just an alias. But because I know SV points to SV, when you know what things point to, you can do a lot. I know SV points to SV. Therefore, it is an alias for SV. Modifying star SV2 is the same as modifying SV. And even though I got these pointers from unrelated paths, the correct invalidation occurs because I know just at one step, he points to him. Or he points to an object owned by this owner. So let's just summarize the rest of what happens locally in functions. If you have a branch, you might point to more than one thing. You might assign P to one object or to another object on different branches. That's okay, we just merge them and say P might point to X or Y and follow that through. Loops are very much like branches. If you have points to null, you can remove that with a null check. Try-catch is handled. We make pessimistic assumptions about all the invalidations and none of the revalidations in the try if you get to the catch. For more details of these and examples and walkthrough, see the paper. But now let's talk about calling other functions. Because everything so far has been local. I mean, if we did nothing but this local stuff, we would catch boatloads of errors. And I'd be very happy with that. But people keep calling functions, so let's do something about that. What do you need to do to make that true? You need to guarantee that P lives long enough for the lifetime of the function call, and you need to guarantee, and this one's subtle, and if you've been bitten by it, you will appreciate this right away. You have to guarantee that F, as a side effect, cannot accidentally invalidate, including through reentrancy, whatever is keeping P alive. Now, that was a long phrase. How many of you recognized it and say, oh yeah, I've lived that? Way too many people. That's the kind of phrase you shouldn't get at first blush, and you only get when you've lived it many times. Let's talk about the rules. In the callee, now, if I'm inside a function and I get a pointer parameter, I'm just going to assume it's good for the lifetime of the call. Yeah, I don't care it fell off the end of your uncle's truck. Looks good to me. I'll trust you on this one. Now, that's initially, if I then reset it, if it's a non-const pointer, then I know it's lifetime and I've done something else with it. But by default, with the value it came in, I assume it's good for the lifetime of my call. And in fact, that's nearly always true because that's what nice stack nested scope semantics gives you. Now, how do we make that true? We enforce that you don't pass anything that you know that the callee could invalidate. This is the number one problem people come across, number one correctness problem with smart pointers. It's because they're not using them correctly, but it's a subtle thing and it's easy to make this mistake. So let's diagnose it. You've got two functions, F, that just takes a pointer, and G, that takes a shared pointer and a pointer. Okay. We start with a global shared pointer, GSP. Now, in my function, I'm going to call f with gsp.get. Now, if you just look at that first line that's in red, f call f with gsp.get, what's wrong with that? Even without reading the comment, like, what's wrong with that? F could invalidate that. It doesn't know the pointer you passed happens to be pointing to something owned by the global variable GSP, which, hint, is a global variable. F can change it. So F could, or something F calls, 100 function calls down, could, as a side effect, write to GSP. And now what do you say about that pointer that you handed that poor function? We should be ashamed of ourselves. We gave it a pointer it could invalidate. What's the solution? Now, in my CppCon talk last year, we covered this material, but we covered it as English text saying, thou shalt and thou shalt not. So when you pass this, at the top of your call tree where you're going to convert a shared pointer or any smart pointer to a pointer, take a copy once, so you're not taking a whole bunch of increment decrements. You take one local copy of that shared pointer in this case, and then you get a raw pointer from that and you pass it down. Well, that gives you a reference count that the callee cannot possibly change. And it completely prevents that pointer from being invalidated. But you have to remember to do that. Now, how many of you knew that that's what you're supposed to do? Take a copy of the shared pointer before you turn it into a raw pointer and pass it down a call tree. Good. Wouldn't you like help for when you forget? And the majority of us who didn't know it or don't remember it all the time, wouldn't we like help too? Now, when we call a G, notice that if we call G with a shared pointer and a dot get, a pointer we got from that same shared pointer, G takes a shared pointer in ref, G could modify the shared pointer. Now, G has no idea whether the instar you gave it points to an int that's owned by that shared pointer. If he modifies it, he could invalidate the pointer. So we're going to say, even though this could be safe sometimes, we don't know. Furthermore, dollars to donuts, you don't know. And we're going to say that that's invalid. However, it's perfectly valid to call G with one smart pointer and a pointer that doesn't point into it. And we know, because we know what pointers point into. sp.get gives you a pointer that points to sp prime, points to the thing owned by sp. GSP, perfectly fine. By the way, even if they alias, that's still okay because modifying GSP won't bump the ref count down to zero and won't invalidate the other pointer because you've got the local one. So even if they pointed to the same thing, that last line is fine. This is the number one correctness issue using smart pointers. People say, I use smart pointers religiously. I use them faithfully. And then I call down, I call into some other language and I get reentrancy. And just sometimes my pointers get modified and things dangle and I don't know when the side effect happens. And this is the kind of advice we give them, is to get those local roots before you turn it into a pointer. It only costs you one ink, and then you get this free raw pointer all the way down your million line call tree. But wouldn't it be nice if a tool could help us with this?
Let's see. Maybe we can be smarter about smart pointers, right? Let's have a look. Must be up to example number 4, is that right? Mm-hmm. Yes, oh, there it is. Okay, so you said this was bad code, right? Let's see if it is. Thinking, oh, looks like the tool agrees.
So what does it say?
It's telling us that the result of calling get on GSP could be accessed and invalidated by F itself. Pretty much what you said.
Okay. Well, the way we tell people if they get this, you don't want to just give people errors on their code. You want to say, here's what you do instead. Well, here, what would you do instead? You take a local copy of the pointer, right? Before you
right.
pass it down that call tree. The smart pointer, that is. So the easiest way to do that,
there you go.
And then remember to call.
Whoa. Remember to scroll off the screen.
And then we pass sp.get.
Right. We save. Let's see, does the software agree with the people? And yes, it does.
Cool. Now, I believe in our current tool that if you passed gsp.get, you would still get the error, I think. And I think that we can continue working on the shared ownership model and make that be a non-error. Because as long as you've got some local root, we might be able to reason about that there is somebody keeping it alive. Right now, we don't go to those efforts. We just say, We just know who you point to, and it's to somebody else, and that's good enough. So now, try calling G. Let's say we call G instead with, what was it? SP, sp.get?
Okay.
That's one way to try to freak it out.
Let's see what it thinks.
So now G is getting a reference, modifiable reference to SP, and a pointer derived from SP, although it doesn't know that.
And we did the wrong thing again. So this time, result.get was invalidated again by G.
Ah, now this is interesting because this is not quite the error I told you about. Because there are two rules that catch this error. The one is you don't pass something to a pointer to a function that it could invalidate. And it could invalidate SP because it gets a non-const reference to it. But this is caught by the more basic rule we already covered, which was, hey, look, that's a non-const use of SP. Even before you try to make the call, you invalidated sp.get because the act of attempting to pass SP to something that takes it by non-const, we assume it's going to modify it. That is a non-const use of SP. So either one of those rules, even if you turn one of them off, to make that code compile, you'd have to turn two rules off to make that code compile. Thank you very much, Neo.
Pleasure.
That's cool. But don't go too far, because we still need number 24. Smart pointers are great. They're commonly misused. That is the number one correctness issue with smart pointers, reentrancy, the side effect of accidentally kicking the bucket that your pointer is standing on. Don't want that. The number one performance issue with smart pointers, that's not about lifetime, but I covered that last year with the guidance of how to pass parameters, and people pass shared pointers way too often when you should just pass raw pointers. Only pass a smart pointer when you want to say something about ownership, ownership transfer, ownership sharing, that kind of thing. So other guidelines deal with that. With these two sets of guidelines, we can remove most of the reasons and misconceptions people have about using smart pointers incorrectly. I won't talk about that guideline because it's not about lifetime, but this is two sides. The two number one problems of smart pointers we believe are solvable and solved. Now, sometimes you want to override the defaults. In STL, there are a bunch of functions. Let's pick on insert. There's insert with hint that takes an iterator. Now, that iterator had better be into the same container. The English text says so, and we all know we can rely on the compiler to respect English text. Yes, there's an uncomfortable mutter there. And so we want to say, hey, those two are the same. Now, the default I said for pointers passed in is that they are independent. So we would have to override that and say, no, the this pointer, which is an owner, is related to the iterator passed in. So we could say that with the first overload of insert, the draft syntax for that, we're still figuring out the syntax, but the draft syntax is say, hey, make it be the same time as lifetime of this or lifetime of this prime, and then they're related. Now, then there's another overload of insert. I pick on insert because it's a handy function that has an overload with different lifetime rules, because the other overload of insert takes a range. This is the range insert we've probably all used. That had better be pointing to somebody else, not into me, because I'm taking values I'm seeing over there and inserting them into my own representation. In fact, the standard helpfully says in English text that compilers can't do much with, that iterator pair had better be not into my container. Furthermore, well, that's okay. That part's the default, is that the pointers are point to different things, are independent. But in this case, we also want them to point to the same thing, so we don't accidentally pass an iterator into my vector and an iterator into my other vector, which is not a range. So here we want to say, as shown in the last line, that the second parameter has the same lifetime as the first. It points to the same thing as the first. And you know what? We can do that. So if I have a map with a couple of entries, and I have a second map, M2, so I've got two maps, M and M2. If I say m.insert M2 begin some value, well, I'm going to get an error under these rules because M2 begin points to M2, not to M. That in this call to insert, I should be passing an iterator into the same container, and I'm not, so I get an error. But if I say m.insert mbegin, the green line, everything's okay, so that's how I fix it. Now if I call the second one, if I call m.insert m.begin, m.end, that middle line. Well, there's two errors. The parameters point to m, which they shouldn't, and m is modifiable by m.insert, so I actually invalidate those iterators right away. Badness. So we don't want that to compile, and we don't. But what if I say the third red line, m.insert, m2begin, m.end? So I'm passing an iterator pair that isn't really a pair. It's the two different containers. Error, param1 points to m2, but param2 points to m. And the error message can be that clear. They should point to the same thing. If they do point to the same thing, last line, that works. Remember I said all this is done at compile time? We believe that this will eliminate large classes of iterator range errors with zero debug instrumentation, purely at compile time. We have all passed invalid iterator ranges, where we've passed begin of M1 and begin of M2, and the wrong thing happened. We aim to catch those, because iterators are just pointers. They're capital P pointers. They indirect to something, and they don't own the thing that they indirect to. So now, finally, let's talk about pointers you get out of functions. And again, when I say pointers, I mean capital P. It could be an iterator, it could be an array view, it could be anything. Here's the example. Have you ever asked yourself that question? I'm seeing nods. Is that Detlef nodding heavily there? If you were in Detlef's talk yesterday about concurrency, you will appreciate why he's... The head just kept going. It was great to see. Let's talk about it. Now, I want to point out that we're going to talk about defaults, but the correctness does not depend on the defaults. The defaults are only to minimize annotation. In principle, think of the top part only. In principle, you always have to state the lifetime of a return pointer. The caller assumes the lifetime, and we ensure that it's correct when we compile the callee, because we can tell whether he lied or not when we compile him separately. Now, as soon as you say that, you have to state, you think, oh great, here comes all the heavy annotation. Turns out that languages are pretty regular. Code is pretty regular. Ever since the dawn of computing, we know where most outputs of any function, forget about pointers. If you get an int out of a function that takes two ints, where do you suppose it came from? Dollars to donuts, it came from those two ints you passed in. Yes, they could have gone to a static. Yes, they could have done some side effect. But nearly always, your function outputs come from the inputs. You want a way to override that default in the cases that's not true. That's fine, like a singleton. But that's fine. You want, but that should be the default. And if it's true for ints, why on earth isn't it true for pointers? If I get a pointer out of a function, its dollars to donuts comes from the inputs, from the owners and the pointers that were passed into the function. And if we make that the default, and we do, you need zero annotation for the vastly common case. The next most common case is when there are no parameters at all, or just a parameter like an int. There's no owner or pointer parameters. Then we assume the lifetime is static. We assume you're pointing to something static. Turns out then you don't have to annotate singleton instance functions either, and things like them. Only if it's something else, which we catch when you separately compile the callee and the default is wrong, we say, oh, you can't compile the callee in this lifetime model until you say what its lifetime actually is, because you said it's this, and you say you're returning this. Pick one. So you can actually just cut and paste from the error message and say, okay, it's lifetime this. Put it on your declaration, and then we're good. The best way to state a lifetime is like this. And this is what I don't like about Rust and Cyclone and C-Cured is there's too heavy annotation. You should not need any annotation at all in most functions. And Rust actually has some nice defaults. They do some of these same things. But you shouldn't really have to talk about regions or scopes at all. So let's call some functions. The vast majority of cases, I said, were derived from the owner and pointer arguments. So if I call a function that takes two int stars and it returns an int star, I'm going to assume by default ret points to star p or star q. This is like a branch. I treat it basically like a branch. Just like an if condition, ret equals star p, else ret equals star q. I basically do the same thing. Now, what if I pass an owner, or I pass a string ref, and I get a char star? we are going to assume, not because it's a char star, it could have been an int star. It's a very dumb rule. But we just say, hey, you know what, that pointer you returned, betcha it points into its parameter, into the owner that you passed as an argument. And because it's an owner, remember, we say owner prime. We assume it points to something owned by the owner you passed in. Remember, there's just owners and pointers. It's simple. If it's a pointer, you copy the points to set. If it's an owner, you take the owner's name prime. It's something he owns. That's the default. Now, it turns out temporary objects in C++ are kind of interesting. Not in a bad way, but in fact, C++ has a very clear model about lifetime values, about L values and R values, and now a bit finer grain than that, PR values, X values. And that works very, very elegantly and nicely with this. I'm going to describe it. I'm just coining this term. So it's just not a term you'll find in the standards. It's one I made up because it was handy. I'm going to talk about owner R value weak magnets and strong magnets. So what is a weak magnet for an R value? Well, a const reference parameter can attach to L values, but it can also attach to R values. You can bind that to a temporary object. But it's not the only thing it mostly binds to. Often it binds to regular objects. So I'm going to call that a weak magnet for an R value. And when that's a reference to an owner, like say you could be passing in a temporary vector, by default, I'm not going to assume you're passing a pointer that you got from that. It could have been a temporary. I'm generally going to ignore those unless there were no real owners that I know that are not likely to be temporaries. If there are no other candidates, then I'll consider const string ref, const owner ref parameters. What I will never consider is owner ref ref parameters, because those are just begging to be attached to temporary objects. The only thing that can really attach to, or should attach to conceptually, is either a temporary, in standardese terms, a PR value, a pure R value. And you don't want to return a pointer into one of those because he's about to go away. You know that for sure. The other thing is what's called an X value or an expiring R value. That's something you call std move on at the call site, essentially, or something very like that. Now, why don't we want to return a pointer to something like that? You don't, the function body doesn't have to move from it, but it's supposed to, it's expected to. So you're passing either a temporary or something that's not a temporary, but you're still expected to move from. Yeah, I don't think you want to pass back a pointer into that, because I know its lifetime is about to end. So here's the example of fine match. It takes a string ref and a const string ref. By default, I'm only going to consider the first owner because the second is a weak R value magnet. So I'm going to assume that char star points into the string, not into the match. And then at all my call sites, whether I pass an L value, a literal, a temporary object, a user-defined literal, it's all the same. I just assume the pointer is good for as long as the string is alive, regardless of what the second parameter is. And you can see some of these call sites, if I did return a pointer to the second argument, that would be bad, because some of those are about to go away. In the callee, now you might say, well, that's great, but how do you know it's correct? The callee could actually do something else. Well, not if you compile it. If you compile it and say it returns a pointer it got from S, that's fine, because it's getting a pointer that has S prime, using the internal function parameter name, and it's trying to convert that to a pointer, return that as a pointer that points to S prime, that's compatible. So you're allowed to do that. But if you take the address of something in sub and you get a pointer that points into sub, I'm not going to let you, by default, return that as a pointer that points to S. That's not the same thing. So you'll get an error there if you try to compile that code and either fix the code. It's probably a bug. If you tried to do this, it's probably a bug. Or if you really, really meant it, then advertise it and annotate the char star you're returning to say that you're returning lifetime sub instead. And this is true even if you try to mix it up through temporary objects and local values and different control paths. And this is exactly what vector subscript operator does. It returns a reference, just like a pointer, into star this prime. It just happens to be the this pointer, the owner is the invisible this object. The same thing of begin. It happens to return an iterator into this. So star this prime is what it points to. It can be invalidated if you modify this vector. Now, we have just a minute. Let me see. Is there Gabby? Is Gabby in the room somewhere? Oh, there you are. Okay. So I've been getting email from a brilliant friend of mine named Andrei Alexandrescu. And Andre really is brilliant, and he's done a lot of good work for C++. Where'd he go? Oh, there you are. And other languages. But he emails me about every year saying, when's the committee going to fix std::min? And I was talking with you about this. And by the way, Gabby did not know I was going to do this to him. So this is why I asked you to sit near an aisle. So you were telling me, Gabby, that you got similar emails. So how long has Andre been asking you about std::min?
Yeah, so the first time we talked about this was around 1998. That was before Facebook and Google Groups.
Okay, so now looking at this, what's wrong with std::min, or what's the potential danger?
So Andre's point was that the parameters were const t-refs, and if you you call min on temporary as arguments, then you'll get a reference back.
So what about this call here? I have x and y ints and min of x and y. That's okay, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's efficient. That's why min returns a reference.
Fantastic.
Oh, but under maintenance, what if I make it that?
Oh, God. God bless you.
It's a sneeze. Okay, we'll call it a sneeze. And it's data dependent, because this might or might not fall over depending on the value of x and y.
Yeah.
Okay, what if I make it some function call? Are those okay?
Oh, God.
Thank you, Gabby. Thank you, Gabby, very much. It depends on what the functions return. So Andre's going to be here, and I would have done this to him, but he's not flying in until tomorrow morning. It's okay. We'll all tell him. But it's okay. He's already seen this, in fact, and so it's a very good observation. Andre is completely correct and has rightly been complaining about it for almost 20 years, that this could happen. Now, true, you have to bind a reference and so forth, but it's still a trap for the unwary. Wouldn't it be nice if we could get error messages that say these things? Neil, could you show this example?
Yes, indeed.
This is for you, Andre.
Okay, so here we have the same old example as you had. I've written up an F2 and an F3, even implemented min here so everybody can see we're not cheating under the covers. So this looks like good code, right? We're returning things that live long enough. And yes, we think it's good code.
Okay, but now try to change that to min x comma y plus 1, because then we're passing a temporary in, right?
Okay. Compiler still thinks it's valid. Let's see.
And that's because this compiles, that code compiles on every compiler.
Ooh, but the tool doesn't.
Ah, what's it saying?
It's telling us now that the result of min is being invalidated by some allotemp variable name, which looks horrible.
So we'll fix up these error messages.
Yes.
But that's another way of saying... But that's another way of saying the temporary object y plus 1.
Exactly right.
Now, what if you change that to a call to f?
Okay.
F2, we'll try F2, because that returns a reference to a static. Because that one really ought to be okay.
Okay, well, if you say so, let's see.
Because notice F2 takes no parameters, so we assume that the pointer you get back, which in this case is spelled ampersand, is a pointer to something static, which should be okay.
Analysis agrees.
Okay, we'll try F3, because okay. F3 returns by value. That should be like any other temporary object.
Okay, run analysis and see what it says. Oh, it agrees with you again.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And thank you, Andre. So that's the lifetime profile. I heard a bit of buzz in the hallway yesterday after Bjarne said, we think by identifying the owners, distinguishing owners and pointers, and tracking what pointers point to, we can eliminate lifetime errors. And I heard some grumbling of stuff like, that sounds like magic. But it's Bjarne saying it. He doesn't say stuff that's random. There must be more to this. And there was more than fit into one keynote, so we had two talks. And I hope that this has been useful to you, because we are very hopeful this may crack a 40-year nut in solving lifetime problems safely without heavy annotation in C++, as it's largely written today, without relying on things like garbage collection or heavy annotation or a new language. Now, having said that, we're still working on some things. We're still finalizing the 1.0 design paper. Earlier today, I pushed the 0.9.1 design paper, which contains everything except most of the formal rules that a compiler implementer would implement. Those are still being refined, but put most of the model and some of the formal rules, and that's in the CPP core guidelines repository right now under /docs, so you can see that after the talk. And we aim to share this prototype next winter. In fact, I know people are going to ask, when can we get this? And the answer is not right away. It's a prototype. So, Neil, what expectations should we have as to when, at least from this one, and we hope others will implement it too, but at least from this tool in Visual Studio, when should people expect to be able to see that?
Right. Well, we are sharing our prototype releases of the bounds and types checkers in the same time frame as Visual Studio Update 1 for 2015. So that's very soon. And then, you know, shortly afterwards, you should see a prototype for the Lifetimes checker drop as well.
Yeah, so the lifetime, hopefully in a few months, but in the next month or two, that's when you should see the CTPs and the update one of the other two, the bounds and the types, the type profiles as well. So can safety make C++ simpler? Yes, we can eliminate classes of errors. That's the easy answer. But it also makes our coding style simpler. We already saw min and max. But why do smart pointers not convert to raw pointers implicitly? Why do we have to dot get all the time? I have answered this question at many companies because everybody initially writes the conversion to TSTAR. Then they realize, oh, darn, that means some code I didn't mean to compile compiles because of pointer arithmetic. I convert to TSTAR and I add 42. Oh, that's helpful. Worse, I might dereference that, then it's a wild pointer. Or I might dangle a pointer. I might get a valid pointer, but I didn't quite realize it was a raw pointer, and so I wasn't paying attention to the lifetime of the smart pointer, so it dangles. Well, if we do have a solution where we have a subset of C++ where there are no dangling and no bounds violations, there should be no reason that smart pointers can't just convert to TSTAR. I don't know of anything that can go wrong. That's a conjecture, but it's an example of how safety simplifies library design. So this is all about ISO C++. It continues to evolve. The things we've learned in this handful of types, we hope to feed back into standardization, who I'm sure will make them even better or find something different, that a better replacement. That's something the committee does very well. But here is a set of tools that we've found, types and rules, that can give you type and bounds and even lifetime safety for leaks and dangling, and nearly all of it statically at compile time with no runtime overhead. Again, acknowledgements to many people who have already given their input to it and many more of you who are working on this core guidelines project. So far, you've seen Bjarne's talk and my talk about it. Here are some related talks to watch for. After lunch, Gabby is going to talk about modules, which is an area of interest that overlaps with safety because it helps us to put limits on macro leakage and things like that. Neil, who we saw here on stage, is going to give two talks tomorrow on static analysis about more than just what we've talked about here. There'll be other topics as well, and more about ArrayView and StringView and how they work. Gabby then follows up with contracts, and please come on Friday to the plenary session, the keynote, the endnote by Eric Niebler of ranges, because those two are about bound safety. Instead of a raw iterator and doesn't know its bounds, I know the bounds of what I'm talking about. They are also about bound safety. Please enjoy those talks. Thank you again for all of your interest already in the repository. The way it's trending worldwide is really a gratifying thing to see because it's something that's clearly useful to people. Please help us make it better. We need help. We can't do it ourselves. And we hope you've enjoyed this material and the rest of the conference. Thank you very much for coming.